Can't Spell Inclusion Without a D, the podcast that explores the power of inclusion and why disability is an important part of the workplace diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation. Produced by the Ontario Disability Employment Network, with your hosts, Jeanette Campbell and Dean Askin. It's an ism with seven letters. It happens in workplaces, in communities, and in society in general, every day. Maybe you have lived experience facing it.
Or maybe you've practiced it without even consciously realizing it. It's so commonly happening in so many ways that, as American lawyer Haben Girma put it, it's often hard to identify because it just seems so normal.
Now, Haben Girma, by the way, is the first person with a disability who holds a Harvard Law degree. Hi there, I'm Dean Askin, and this is episode 20 of You Can't Spell Inclusion Without a D. And that ism I mentioned off the top is ableism.
And this episode, we're going to get a perspective on disrupting ableism in the workplace, why it's happening, its many forms, its impact, and what can and needs to be done about it. Hello, I'm Jennifer Croson, at the other mic this episode, sitting in for Jeanette Campbell. And I have to say it, that for weeks I've really been looking forward to this conversation.
I remember the email, Jennifer, that you sent me when I was in the midst of lining up the episodes for this season, and you said you'd just seen our two guests in a lunch webinar and they had some great insights and we should have them on the show. And well, here we are. You know, it's great to have you filling in for Jeanette. Welcome as co-host. I guess this is kind of a new experience for you. Last time you were on the show, you were answering questions. That was last season in episode 10, by the way, for our listeners. A great conversation about building a future of employment for youth who have a disability.
It's going to be a different experience asking the questions from the co-host chair, and I'm excited.
Well, let's get to it then, Jennifer. With us in the guest chairs are Shreen Alamathu and Fran Odette.
Sari is the co-executive director of Toronto Neighborhood Centres. She's also a documentary filmmaker and a passionate storyteller, community builder, relationship builder, and advocate for social change.
Fran Odette has more than 25 years of experience in disability advocacy, activism, and education. She co-designed and co-teaches a critical disability studies course titled Disability Discourse, The Experienced Life at George Brown College in Toronto.
As we kind of mentioned at the beginning of 2024, Sari and Fran did a Maytree 5 Good Ideas webinar about 5 ways to disrupt ableism in the workplace. And now they're here on You Can't Spell It Inclusion Without a D to share their insights and perspectives on that ableism. Sari Nalamathu and Fran Odette, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Let's get into this with the what question first. You know, the term ableism has been around for almost 40 years, but just a few years ago in 2021, Haben Girma, the American lawyer that we mentioned at the top of the show, the first deafblind person to graduate from Harvard Law School, she said in a magazine interview that the term ableism is still new to a lot of people. So what exactly is ableism and how would you define it? What forms does it take?
So ableism, and the definition that I'm going to give is from the Ontario Human Rights Commission. Ableism may be defined as a belief system analogous to racism, sexism, or ageism that sees persons with disabilities as being less worthy of respect and consideration, less able to contribute and participate, or of less inherent value than others. Ableism may be conscious or unconscious and may be embedded in institutions, systems, or the broader culture of a society. It can limit the opportunities of persons with disabilities and reduce their inclusion in the life of their communities. I want to also just say, if I can, I think we have had 40 years, but I want to also say that I think disabled people have been around for much longer than 40 years. And so I think, you know, We finally have a definition to an experience of prejudice and discrimination that I think many of us have experienced for more than just 40 years, especially in a world that does see people with disabilities through a deficit model. Sri, I don't know if you have anything that you would want to add.
I do want to add that, you know, the approach that we've been taking together in the work we do within the neighborhood centers is a disability justice framework. And by the way, the definition we're working from comes from Patty Byrne, who's the founder and executive and artistic director of Sins Invalid, which is a disability justice-based performance project. And disability justice is an intersectional framework which recognizes how ableism is connected to other forms of oppressions and centers the voices of disabled people of color, immigrants with disabilities, queer people with disabilities, trans and gender nonconforming people with disabilities, people with disabilities who are houseless, people with disabilities who are incarcerated, people with disabilities who've had their ancestral land stolen, amongst others. So I think bringing a disability justice framework in a conversation around ableism is really important.
I totally agree with both of you and really appreciate those perspectives that you bring to this conversation. You know, so why do you think that Haben Girma said that ableism is new to people? And this is only in 2021, especially given what you said, Fran.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think for those of us who have a lived experience of disability, ableism isn't so new. I do think, however, we are now seeing what is often a common experience as really being a form of oppression. And an essential part of EDI work is also a newer component. And as a result, I think that the conversations do see the importance of including information about ableism similar to other forms of oppression, such as racism, sexism, heterosexism, and so many other areas where people experience discrimination.
Yeah, I mean, it's the language, right? It's as we start, you know, as having language that helps us sort of talk about things, I think, is helpful. And I think maybe the language, like a more sort of shared language to sort of address some of this stuff is what's newer. But I agree with Fran. I think, you know, obviously this is not a new thing, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, I want to sort of pick it up here and sort of come off of something that you said, Fran. You know, you said, you know, people with disabilities have been around a lot longer than the term ableism and have experienced things. I mean, tell us what ableism means to you on that personal level. I mean, you know, what kinds of things have you experienced that are ableist?
I don't mean to be funny when I say this, but like, where do I begin? Honestly, you know, I think that I have always experienced some form of ableism, even as a young child and definitely as a young person. You know, being not quite seen as fully whole or fully human, assuming that when I'm waiting for Wheel-Trans that I must be, you know, out on the street asking for money. I mean this with tongue in cheek, but, you know, occasionally I've made lots of money just waiting for Wheel-Trans simply because someone assumed that that must be what I'm doing and that I need it more than they do. And so, you know, I think really at the core of that whole experience is this belief that who I am is defined by my impairment, or what people perceive as my impairment. And also because of that, I am considered, as many of us are, as being somewhat inferior to non-disabled people. And so I also want to have us think about this idea of ableism, is that it's not just around disability, it's also experiences around autism. So the belief that hearing people are, you know, privileged, and that deaf and hard of hearing people all want to be hearing. And the idea as well around the notion of sanism. So thinking that there are quote unquote typical ways that mental health is experienced for many of us, but we also know that mental health for lots of people can be quite precarious and is not well understood in the larger society. And again, is something that is steeped in myths and stereotypes.
And for so long, these kinds of things just weren't talked about. That was a powerful insight. Sri, what does ableism mean to you?
I don't know that I can add much more. I think Fran summed it up really well. But I think about it as, a lot of gross assumptions about what we're all supposed to look like, think like, be like. Like this idea that we all, there's like some ideal model of what a whole human being is, I think, with a complete disregard for the variety of ways we show up in this world.
Those are both powerful insights, and I guess it's a challenge. I mean, that's something I want to pick up on. Something else Haben Girma said in that 2021 interview she did with Africa Renewal magazine, because that was what she said here. It was the headline of the piece, and she said, "The biggest challenge is ableism, not my disability." What do you think about that? Whoever wants to jump in and answer that.
I think this is such a powerful headline because it really is demanding that we as a society move away from the medical model that does uphold ableist ideology and sees the disability within the individual. And so if the individual can just do X, then they will be able to quote unquote overcome their disability. But in contrast, I think what this headline is saying is that it really is the prejudice and the attitudinal barriers that contribute to both the physical and environmental social barriers that are disabling. That would be what we would call the social model. The social model really challenges us to see the problem of disability outside of the individual and really see that attitudes are behind the barriers that are created in the physical environment and also the social environment. And it's not to say that impairment doesn't exist, but that it's just part of being human.
Beautifully put, Fran.
I agree. I don't know, Sri, if you have anything to add to that, but I want to take us even a deeper dive. It's 2024, and we're in the middle of the third decade of the 21st century. Why do either of you think or want to comment on why we think ableism in the workplace is still happening?
I mean, I think it's because it's deeply embedded in the way we think about productivity. Right. One thing that comes to mind is when we can't show up for work fully, if we are, we need to take some time off for whatever reason, it's always sort of looked at as failing the system, right? Versus the system failing us, because there's no room for us to sort of, care for ourselves in the ways that we need. So I think, a lot of it is ableism shows up when, we think about who we are in relation to what we produce, right? And only in relation to what we produce or not producing. I also think there's, just a lot of resistance, and and if it's easier to ignore that it exists, right? And it's easier to just sort of default to the status quo, because it's a lot of work, right? To sort of that self-reflective process about how we see each other, how we keep ourselves from othering each other. It's hard work to do. And I think sometimes we're, especially in our sector, you know, there are a lot of fires people are putting out every day, right? In the frontline work that they do. And we're not given sort of the opportunity to sort of think about reimagining the way we show up for ourselves as coworkers, as well as, you know, the ways in which we deliver programming and services. I think we need to think about how we can do things differently. And if we're not making time for that, then it's not, we're not changing, you know, the culture of our workplaces.
You know, as someone who is on the other side of receiving and being impacted by ableism as well as a disabled person, I think there's a lot of discomfort to have these really difficult conversations. I think people think they know what ableism is, but there's a lot of literacy in lots of different sectors around what that language means and how part of our efforts to address and begin to eradicate ableism is to be really mindful of our language and how language, even on its own, can be ableist, because we tend to use that language to talk about deficiencies, and we may use that language that describes other people's experiences through that particular lens. You know, like, it's so crazy out there, like, or, you know, what a lame idea that was. And can we not come up with other ways of describing what is going on other than using language and the categorizing of people's lived experiences in such negative ways?
You know, I can sort of sense the frustration in your voice. And, you know, as you were answering that, I mean, how frustrating is it that, you know, all of this ableism in all of these forms is still happening and in 2024? And that it's still difficult to have difficult conversations.
You know, I've been on this planet for like 60 plus years. So, you know, it's been a long time. And, you know, I can't say that there's been a lot of change in terms of the impact that it does have for folks with disabilities to be always having to do the emotional labor of responding to ableist incidents that might happen in a workplace or elsewhere. And I think, you know, the underlying issue and why it's so frustrating is because there still is this belief that disabled people, whether we are your colleagues, whether we are your customers, whether we are your third party, whatever you call it, as soon as you get a sense that we have a disability, there is a change in someone's perspective. Even though they may like not want to admit it, that there's always this underlying view that is centered on less than or deficit. And, you know, there's a real sort of undermining, I think, of people's experiences when they are able to, you know, achieve leadership roles, that somehow they must have done something extra, because how could they be a leader and also have a disability? And so, yeah, I mean, there's always this feeling, you know, from my perspective, of having to be better. I have to be better than my non-disabled peers, because I'm much more dispensable than they are. And that's very much the belief that I think lots of us encounter in our workplaces, unless we are in workplaces that really value and appreciate people's contributions on multiple levels rather than just through a capitalist lens. Sri, I don't know, as far as your perspective and our doing this work together, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the more frustrating things is the idea that, in doing the work, thinking of it as an add-on, right? So when we have time, we will think about this form of oppression versus thinking about, like, you know, this is, it doesn't exist because it's not on your plate, right? Just the idea that even in doing EDI work, that the A is missing, accessibility is missing. There are some fantastic advancements in that, like there's some fantastic advocates, like bringing that more attention to that, right? And I think people are hearing it now more than before, so that's really great. But I think it's frustrating to think about always, even before you get to the work, having to make an argument for why this work is important. I think that becomes, frustrating, because it's a strange thing to talk about why, I don't know, just to have to make an argument, right, that we should be doing this. Another sort of observation that I've noticed in the past year and a half, Fran, that we've been working together, is the number of folks who are quiet about or aren't comfortable, right, revealing disabilities that they live with, right, because it's not a safe environment to do that. And it's not safe because we, it's the ways in which we, like you were describing, we just sort of default to judging people. And even if we have the language, we say all the right things, I think culturally, you're right, Fran, like there's still ways in which we categorize people, we put people in hierarchies, right, of value. And I think that's something that you to do this work, to talk about this, it really has to start with culture change. You can put all the rules and regulations in place, you can put all the sort of policies that address discrimination and harassment, all of that in place. But until we sort of make a culture shift, those things do not live, right, in ways that are beneficial to everyone.
Do you think all of these different forms of ableism, is it intentional, or does it just mostly happen because there's such a lack of awareness and people are ableist without even realizing it? I mean, is it like Eben Grima said, that there are lots of examples of ableism, but they're just hard to recognize just because they seem so normal?
I mean, I don't think it's a question of intention. I think we need to start talking about impact. So impact versus intention. And when we sit in that place of intention, it just sort of, it's a way of stalling the actual work that it requires of us, the self-reflection that it requires of us, the changes, that it requires of us. Because we all have work to do, right? Whether it's like realizing how it shows up in ourselves, how it shows up in our communication, how it, so I think it's important to sort of think more about impact. And I don't know, it's an interesting question about the idea of normal, that's another question I have, is like, what is this idea we have of normal? And is that even healthy? And maybe it started to start thinking again, you know, sort of differently about like, what do we mean by normal? Like normal itself becomes a challenging term. Normal to who? And I think, you know, one of the things, if we are able to move it from, intention to impact, I think we can also start to think about how, oftentimes when we do this work, we're accommodating the learners, right? At the cost of people who are we are asking to teach us, right? So when we bring in folks and ask them to share their lived experience as a way for me to learn, that's, you know, thinking about who's paying the cost of this? And then what is my role as someone who needs to sort of do better, be better, learn more so I can do that? I think about questions. I don't know, Fran, does that make sense? Like the idea of where the labor lands, right? We think we're centering the voices of people with lived experience, but it's a dangerous sort of, it's a kind of a dangerous line. Like you can easily overstep.
No, I think you're making a lot of sense, Suri. And I don't know, Fran, if you have anything to add. And I mean, really our next question was, you know, what is the impact of ableism? And you've just answered that question, you know, and I like this distinction between, you know, intention and impact. And that's such an important thing for us to consider, you know. So Fran, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, you know, in terms of the impact of ableism, but I felt that that was a really interesting perspective you were bringing there, Suri.
I have a couple of things that I want to add, and that is, the fact of the matter is that even in 2024, disability is not a particularly sexy thing to talk about. And I don't mean to make light. I think that it brings up feelings of discomfort, you know, for learners. And I think that there's such a fear of making a mistake. And as someone who has been doing this kind of training and work, sometimes I want to just say, like, make the mistake. Because the more that you hold on thinking that you won't, you're going to do something that is going to be not a great experience for the person that it will land on, because you didn't get a chance to unpack that before you came into the conversation. And I think that when I'm being, another, I think, impact of ableism is the fact that I always question myself as someone with a disability, like, did that just happen in this training that was like so blatantly ableist? And am I the only one that saw this? Am I overreacting? How do I respond to what just happened, which is, you know, bringing up feelings for me in a way that responds in a respectful way, but also lets that person not leave the room, not knowing the impact that comment has had on me as a trainer, but who else is in the room who may not have disclosed that they have a disability? Right? I mean, it's a lot of labor, and it also comes at a cost, I think, for many of us who do this work, and I don't think it's valued yet, but it's getting there in the same ways when we do EDI work.
So, Fran, we know that you've worked with organizations and pointed out ableism that's happening in those workplaces. You know, what's generally been the reaction when you've done that?
Oh, well, you know, imagine, right? I mean, I think we can imagine. What's it like when you've been, you know, someone points out that you actually aren't that accessible? And perhaps you have been presenting your company or your program as being uber accessible. And then someone comes in and said, you know what? Here are some things that you could do differently. You can either sit with that and be uncomfortable and go, okay, thank you, I hear that, and what can we do? Or I'm going to be defended, and I'm going to say all the other excuses that I can say, such as, well, this isn't our building, and, you know, we're only here on a temporary lease, and, you know, so on and so forth. Like, I get a range. I'd much rather, you know, I go in always prepared that I will get some kind of defended response. And how do I then try to navigate through that so that people will continue to stay open for the suggestions that I want to make around how things could be better? But I have to say, you know, there are days when I do wonder why I'm doing this work. I want to see more change. I don't want to be going into an agency where they can check off their, you know, boxes and said they've done the training and then nothing actually happens. You've got a piece of paper that says this is what the issue is and your response is, thanks so much, but we can't do any of this.
So what would your reaction be in that situation or solution perhaps if you've come across and, you know, if an organization says this is not possible for us, what might be some solutions or reactions to that?
I think because, and I don't know, Sri, if you've got something that you want to add to that, but I think for me, I will continue to ask that they be accountable. You cannot do this work without recognizing that you are going to have disabled people coming into your space, whether that is as a employee, whether that is as your boss, or whether that is as a, you know, service user, client, member of the public. And you don't want to go to court, do you? You don't want to have a human rights battle with somebody over something that actually could be quite fixable or could be quite navigable if you are open to that. You know, I sound like I'm really like woohoo on this, but you know, sometimes I have to like temper my frustration and say, you know, here's reality.
I guess it's all about getting people to think differently. So, I mean, I know you've kind of mentioned this, but I want to bring it out a little bit more. I mean, you know, what mind shift has to happen out there to stem workplace and society ableism? What's the aha moment that everybody has to have?
I think, and I'll share my aha moment, I think that really shifted things for me. And it was thinking, you know, making this work about the environment and not about individuals, you know, because when we see it as the environment, we can change it, you know, and change that narrative around, you know, having, you know, people need to overcome or be fixed or cured or whatever, you know, all those sort of ways in which we make it about individuals, right? That it's up to the individual to make this work. And when we make it about individuals, we absolve ourselves of having to do any of the work, right? But when we look outside of, you know, it's when we look at and think about it as the environment and environmental barriers, those are things that we can change. And, you know, to the question around, you know, what's your reaction when there is that sort of resistance or people think that they are, you know, doing the work or doing enough of the work? It's, you know, asking them if it's a priority or not, right? I think it's simply making it a priority. And when you make it a priority, then you will do the work, right? But there's no, you know, there's no solution to be had if people are not making it a priority.
I kind of want to build on what Sri's saying, is this idea of priority. And I think one of the things that I often say to folks is, so let's just say that you have an accident after our meeting And are you going to actually be able to come to work? Is that because you're going to be able to navigate the stairs to get up to your office? You know, I really try to get people to realize that disability is not an us and them. It is everyone's experience. That, you know, most people who move through the world as non-disabled are only in that place temporarily. Because, you know, disability can occur through accident or illness or aging. And so it's not something that really, if we are lucky enough to grow old, that we will be able to avoid.
Such an important point.
So why are we so busy avoiding something that many of us will encounter?
Really important point there, Fran. So both of you did the Maitree 5 Good Ideas webinar, which I attended, and it was fabulous. And you talked about ways to disrupt ableism in the workplace. So what do you think are the keys to stemming ableism, and what has to happen?
I mean, you know, it would be great, and I hope that there will be somewhere in this podcast that the link to that talk could be provided. Because, you know, I think there are things that are from that talk that we've also covered in this conversation as well. But I do, you know, one thing that really sort of resonates for me is be prepared that you are going to have people come into your space. Don't operate from a place of reaction, but really think about being proactive so that people can come into your space feeling welcomed and that they can feel a sense of belonging. When people are so busy having to accommodate me, I feel less welcomed. Even though they may interpret their efforts as welcoming me, there's this idea of specialness or othering that happens that doesn't sit well with me, and I'm less likely to come back.
Thank you, Fran.
I mean, I would just add that, I mean, it needs to be resourced. I think this the changes that we need to have happen in our workplaces need to be resourced, both with time and training. It needs to be part of our core budget to make it part of our core work.
Great. I think actually you've both kind of touched on really my next question, which is, you know, what's one critical message that you want business leaders or anybody else listening to this podcast to take away from it? Is there anything you either of you would want to add to what you've just pointed out in terms of really some key big messages?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be accountable. I think, you know, don't make disability an add-on or something you get to when and if you have time, but make it, you know, like I said, a core part of the work you do. I think we really need to foster a culture of trust. And we need to listen to the voices and lived experiences of disabled people and center people who are most impacted by multiple forms of oppression to work toward, you know, a more just society that we're all striving for. And I think also, and Fran, you can maybe add on to this, but just sort of understanding that it's all fluid, right? Like the work is never done in a sense.
Yeah. And I think the work is never done. And I think that if we try to always reach a goal, it means that there's no room for any innovative ideas that can come afterwards. We've done what we've done, and so now we don't need to think about it again. And I think that we always have to revisit these conversations, and we can't just do a one-off. I also want to just add, if I can, very quickly to this idea around fostering a culture of trust. And I think, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up both in workplaces and I think elsewhere is this idea of people having to prove themselves when they need an accommodation. And I, you know, I think that that is the old way. And we really can think about trusting that people know what they need, that disability is not static, and that it will change and does change. And this idea of having to prove yourself in order to get what you need to be able to do your work, I think also then is very undermining of people's own expertise, as opposed to relying on, you know, some kind of documentation that comes from somebody that might have met that person for only 15 minutes, while the person who's asking for the accommodation knows themselves all their life. Right? I mean, I think that it's really important that we kind of really disrupt this idea of professionalism and who really is the expert.
Great point. I mean, you know, we've been talking about the way things are now. So let's look ahead a little bit. I mean, what do you think? Will we eventually, you know, get to that point where workplaces and, you know, indeed society as a whole, I mean, is it ever going to be like, you know, you saw it on Star Trek, The Next Generation, and there's no ableism. I mean, you know, I'm going back here and I'm thinking about, you know, the character of Chief Engineer Geordi LaForge with his visor on the bridge crew, and everyone just carried on business as usual on the bridge on whatever star date it happened to be. I mean, what's your hope? What do you envision?
Well, I mean, I don't really think about the future. I sort of think more about the present, and what we do in the present, I think, tells us where we can go and what we can accomplish. And when I think about the future, it's with my kids in mind, future generations, and what we want for them. And that informs what we need to do now. So I'm sort of very focused on the present and not this idea of, you know, by this time, we will eradicate all of these things. But and you know, ultimately for me, it's just about seeing the humanness in each other. And you know, there's a I'm Indian, and in my country, and it's in grounded in Hinduism is the term namaste, which I think a lot of people are familiar with as a greeting, right? And but the meaning of namaste is the light in me honors the light in you. And I think that for me, that's my mantra in terms of like how I approach this work, in all of this work, right? All of the anti-oppression work we're doing. If we can sort of think about and see each other's humanness and start there, in the present time where we are, we might not, there's something more powerful to me around that and working where I am situated now with the people that I encounter now in the situations I am in now. More power in that for me and inspiration in that than some far off goal of imagining a world without any of this. Because that seems, I don't know, that can start to feel impossible, right? But what makes things feel possible is when you start to see the way in which people start to interact with each other differently. As we learn this language, as we become more sort of aware of the kind of, shift we want to make in terms of the way we look at each other, moving away from othering. I don't know. Like I see small things we do every day. I think even with my colleagues and in our learning and in this journey we've been on for the last year and a half, these small things that are, we call them small, right? Because this big shift hasn't happened, but they're powerful, right? And it's the only way you're going to get to something bigger.
Fran, are you an idealist or looking ahead, or are you pragmatic?
I would love to stay in the present. I'm not really very good at it. I do tend to look to the future. And I would agree with Sri that, you know, there have definitely been changes. Absolutely. I think one of the things that is meaningful to me is that I think we have to, you know, as a community and as younger people are coming, you know, into, you know, thinking about what their lives could look like. And I think many times young people with disabilities think that the work is done, and it isn't. It isn't done. But how do we, I'm saying, you know, myself as an elder who's been doing this stuff for a while, how do I support a young person to not give up on themselves? Because I think that is really what can happen when you continually bump up against barriers that you thought someone else had done the work around.
Great points, great insights from you both. I mean, we've talked about a lot. You've had a lot of great insights. Just before we wrap it up, have we covered all the key points and essentials? What do you think? Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important to mention just before we go?
I hope the conversations will continue. I hope that there'll be more conversations coming out of this one that people will take into their lives. I think that's how change can happen.
Tree?
Yeah, I agree, Fran. I think that's a great note to end on.
Fantastic. I mean, this has really been a great conversation, and I think a really important one to have. You know, I really appreciated the perspectives that both of you brought to our conversation today, you know, particularly this idea of disability justice and really needing to not shift, but to widen the way we're talking about and having this conversation and to understand those different intersections, you know, that individuals face. The other thing was this tension, you know, about not being comfortable to speak up, but you know to talk about what you might need in order to be successful in your job, you know, and seeing that with a kind of human rights lens, and how actually that's how we're going to get the best out of people, is if we best understand how to best support them in their place of employment. So I was really interested in that kind of tension that I think you both really so eloquently and you know pointed out, and I think it's something we have a conversation we have to continue. So I really wanted to thank you, Sri and Fran, for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts and insights about this ism. You know, that is certainly a barrier to people achieving their full potential. And, you know, I am an optimist, you know, and I'd like to think that this conversation really is going to help people start making that mind shift that needs to happen in order to allow, you know, those individuals with disabilities in our community to reach their full potential, which we all know is possible.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks from me as well to Sri and Fran for coming on the show and talking about this with us. If you missed Sri and Fran's webinar about disrupting workplace ableism, we've put a link to the recording and the transcript in the show notes for this episode,
along with some other links where you can learn more about ableism and what employers can do in their workplaces.
That's right, Jennifer. Check out those links, and let's all try to start making the mind shift needed to break down the ableism barrier. And you know, I say that as someone who not only has multiple invisible disabilities, but as a professional communicator who's become a lot more conscious of the turns of phrase I write. And I like to write some colorful ones sometimes, as Jennifer knows. I'm not afraid to admit it's a constant challenge. Now, every once in a while you think, yes, I've nailed it. And then you go, oh, no, wait, that's ableist language, isn't it? Or somebody's looking at your copy and they point out to you that it's ableist and you say, oh, geez, you're right. Didn't even think of that when I wrote the sentence. I'll change that.
It's kind of like a simple math equation. More awareness and conscious thought equals or should equal less ableism. And on that mathematical note of disrupting ableism, that's it for this episode of You Can't Spell Inclusion Without a D. I'm Jennifer Croson, and I have to say, it's been fun guest co-hosting this episode with you, Dean.
It has been fun, Jennifer. Thanks again for sitting in at the other mic. I'm Dean Askin, and thanks again to you out there for listening wherever, whenever, and on whatever podcast app you're listening from. Join us each episode as we have insightful conversations, much like this one, and explore disability inclusion in business and in our communities from all the angles. You Can't Spell Inclusion Without a D is produced in Toronto, Canada, by the Ontario Disability Employment Network. All rights reserved. Our podcast production team. Executive producer and host, Jeanette Campbell. Producer, Sue Defoe. Associate producer and host, Dean Askin. Audio editing and production by Dean Askin. Our podcast theme is Last Summer by Ixon. If you have feedback or comments about an episode, contact us at info@odennetwork.com. That's info@odennetwork.com. Join us each episode for insights from expert guests as we explore the power of inclusion, the business benefits of inclusive hiring, and why disability is an important part of the diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation. Listen to You Can't Spell Inclusion Without a D on Podbean or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.